Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Badass Women's Hour podcast. Three women, one podcast, and a whole load of badass. With me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton. This week's show is a little bit different because we're dedicating it to just one guest. We had actress, director, author, campaigner, activist, all-round badass, Rose McGowan in the studio with us. And we talked about Harvey Weinstein, life after Me Too, and just what it feels like when there's no one you can trust.
Underwear, armpit hair, many imitators, but no one compares.
Badass Women's Hour XL with Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell, and Emma Sexton on Talk Radio.
One, two, three, four!
We are joined in the studio by actress, director, author, campaigner, activist, all-round badass Renaissance woman, Rose McGowan. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, we are very excited. We are going to be talking to Rose for the next hour all about her incredible life, growing up in a cult, being a teenage runaway, moving to Hollywood, her incredible career, book tour, new book, Me Too, and how it has changed basically society and how we talk about it. And if anyone's worrying, we might be talking about Harvey Weinstein and some allegations that he has absolutely denied. So, Rose, thank you so much for coming in. Your new book, Brave, is out in paperback right now. Read it. So the thing that struck me when I first read it was that I did not know how incredible your childhood was, because you actually grew up in a cult.
I did, but I feel most people did. People are like, it's so weird how you grew up. I'm like, so weird how you live. I grew up in a commune, and what helped me realize that most people are in cults too was that it was a very intense version of what society's general indoctrination does to you. But it was in a small multinational group and with really intense desires to kind of make the women and the children bend to their ways, but I kind of fought against that.
What really comes across in the book from that period of your life is this sense of it creating a person who just was going to question the rules. Who, yeah. From the second somebody said you have to do this, even as a 4-year-old, like, why?
No. And no. It was really just the actions weren't matching up with what they were preaching. So none of it was just a logic-based thing for me. Yeah. That was, and I realized at a very young age that the more you kind of bend yourself to make others feel taller, meaning that if they're always asking you about their, do you believe in the God I believe in or whatever that is, if I lied, I would be giving some of myself away, and that just chips away at who you are eventually. So I thought it best not to lie.
Were you kind of alone in your questioning, even from a young child? Were you very much alone in that commune who was really questioning things and being a bit challenging? And
yes. I'm sure there are other people that were adults that were doing things that I wasn't aware of, but as a child, my father was the leader. So I was definitely the one going up against him. And a lot of the women, that were in it, it wasn't just him, it was just part of their tenets. But it had a lot of beautiful side effects, growing up in that commune. it wasn't like, oh, it's so tragic that I didn't get to grow up like everybody else. I'm like, no, I feel bad for most people that grew up in other ways, to tell you the truth, because I saw a lot of beauty. I grew up in Tuscany in a Duke's estate, so suck it.
But going back to cults, because I think we, as human beings, we're really easily manipulated, and we can just assume that that's the way something should be. Do you, I've lost my train of thought now in the question. I've like.
So I guess the thing that's interesting to me is you talk in the book about kind of growing up in a cult, ending up in Hollywood, which is a bit of a cult.
Yeah.
And then starting to see actually how the rest of us in society, we're all living by rules that society has created for us and we go along with, and we're like, okay, we're not going to rock the boat because it's easier for us.
Right. I say rock the boat.
I don't know if you said rock the boat. That's my interpretation.
All right, no, I was saying I would say rock the boat, you know, like what else are you doing?
But I just don't think many people know to even rock the boat.
They don't. That's the whole thing. That's the whole thing. And this is where I say that I have kind of a superpower in that I saw stuff so clearly, and what and how generally the social structure works to indoctrinate young girls and young boys and everybody into their structure, that when you see it in a really intensive version and you disregard it and challenge it, and then you can see a more watered down version that other people get. And because it's watered down, they don't know that they need to fight it. And they don't know that it's essentially that by not fighting it, you're really adhering to a power structure that's not supporting you.
But is it a hindsight superpower, or were you always aware of it? Because
I was always aware of it.
Okay. But what you do with it, I mean, it took that's me a lot.
I was scared of my own power.
Yeah, exactly.
For a long time, as a woman, as a young woman, I was really scared of my own power. I would definitely say I kind of stayed sleepwalking on the exterior of my life for a while I was gaining up the energy to fight.
So you talk about Hollywood being almost like another version of a cult. Did it take you a long while to question that? Because I guess I'm curious as to when you've been in a that sort of environment and you've questioned it and you've seen that.
No,
it's...
I rebelled against
the beginning.
I saw that it was ridiculous, but and this is where I saw, believe me, the absurdities and the injustice. Constantly it ground on me, but there was at the time nothing you could do. There's no power, there's nothing you could do. And I had really long hair and I would kind of hide behind it, and I would just chew the inside of my lip and make it bleed, and I would just suck it down and push it down, and but all the while building a fair bit of rage that would later pop up.
And so we were talking about it just before you came on. I remember watching you in Charmed and very much thinking you were, you know, the bombshell, quote fingers, because of the long hair and the visual. But then there was also the marriage to Marilyn Manson. I was like, well, that's the subversive side of things. And so a couple of questions. Why? I mean, why chew the inside of your mouth instead of just saying, do you know what?
There was no way to do that. There was no social media. There was no way to speak for yourself. And I'm somebody who'd been a homeless teenager.
Yeah.
And you're really, you know, at when you get discovered very young, as I did, and you get famous very quickly, what other job are you going to get?
Mm. You got a
you're
lot
quite
to lose.
Stuck, aren't you? Mm. Yeah. You're really backed into this weird corner. And so now you're in this power structure that doesn't reward anybody who speaks out or thinks differently. And I had to toe the line. I mean, I barely, because I was blacklisted for years. So I had to fight my way around that. The reason I did a TV show called Charmed was because I couldn't get a job in film. Mm. Because I'd spoken up, you know.
I don't know how you feel about it. I loved it personally. I mean, it made my Saturday morning.
I'm so glad.
One of the things that really resonated for me in the book was the fear of being homeless and the fear of being knocked out and just getting on with it and doing whatever you've got to do because it means you've got a home and you've got somewhere to stay. And I was never a homeless teen, but I grew up in a family who were constantly having to move houses.
Right.
And so there was always a kind of like, actually we're packing up and we're gone. Yeah, you never know when you're going to have to go, right?
Right.
And I definitely have that fear, which is if I run out of money, that's it. I'm under a bridge.
Yeah, it's a very deeply rooted fear. And it's one that's really, really hard to rid yourself of. Yeah. And I don't know if you ever completely do.
Do you still have it now?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
How do
I
you
battle
kind
with
of,
it.
Yeah. How do you do that? How do you battle with it?
You just pull up your bootstraps and keep marching on and fight another day. But it doesn't make it... It's like an undercurrent.
Yeah. How do you feel now that you have the book and your message is out there and people really know what you stand for, and people have... They buy into it. They love it. They're so thrilled that you've done it. But it's also presumably destabilized the career you had.
Oh, very much so, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I'm figuring that out. I mean, I have an album coming out that I've been working on for 3 years, and art projects that I've been working on behind the scenes, and kind of honing my skills as a photographer and a visual artist and a director and doing all these things. But, yeah, the real challenge is how do you support yourself at some point, you know, that becomes like a real thing. So it's all coming out in the wash right now, you know. It's both a terrifying and fascinating chapter.
Yeah.
You know, what happens when you're outside of the cult?
Yeah. Are you thankful, though, that you're outside?
Yeah.
And you have options and less feelings of being stuck?
Yes. It was something that I was very stuck. And if I was stuck with, you know, kind of an individualistic mind like mine, then what happens to people that are less brave or less strong, and how stuck are they?
Mm.
And not just in Hollywood, but in any kind of thing of life. I mean, that's the whole thing. My book is not about, it's not even really for women. It's about, it's just human. It's about human nature and societal structures and, you know, and my life stories. But it's definitely... a lot of the stuff that if it happened to me and I can fight, what happens to the people that, you know, aren't there yet?
Mm. You have an amazing ability to be able to look at stuff that is, as a reader, it's traumatic, you know, being homeless as a teenager, having to run away, being shipped between parents, growing up and having abusive relationships, you know, all these, and you seem to be able to look at it in a way that is, I can see what happens, but I'm not defined by it, and I'm not angry at it. How do you?
Right.
How have you made that happen?
Well, are you angry?
Go on, you can tell us. I have moments of anger. Of course, I have anger. My book was written, you know. There's definitely some anger at times running through that, you know. But I've always had this kind of rage and injustice. I've been like that since I was zero.
Yeah.
You know, my father said I was born with a fist up in the air.
But you are incredibly, like, when I look at how you wrote about your parents, there's, you know, you would have legitimate reason to be really angry with them.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you're completely able to see, actually, this is what shaped them and this is why they were the way they were. And this is the stuff I loved about them.
It's a stoic interpretation.
Yeah.
Like, that's the word. It's stoic. And even meeting you now, it's stoic is the thing that's sort of running around in my mind.
I'll take it. you know, there was somebody I met recently. They're like, "You're such a wacky woman," and I was like, "Wacky?" I was like, "I don't know if I would. Maybe I have moods, but I don't think that's the right word to really describe me. I wouldn't say, sir, no."
Okay, well, we are going to keep talking to Rose about whether or not she is a wacky woman. I'm not sure it's the word I would have picked, but here on Badass Women's Hour XL.
The Fempire Strikes Back. Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
Rose, we've talked a little bit about growing up and your childhood, and actually, there's one thing that I wanted to ask you, because we asked you just before you came into the studio, like, have they made a movie of your life yet? And you were like, no, there's one year in particular I wanted to. Tell us about that year.
The 13th year of my life, I think, would make a pretty spectacular kind of a road movie, if you will. It's hard to characterize. So I was a runaway from a hospital where I'd been locked up by an evil stepfather. And so I escaped. And what happens is when you're on the streets, you make friends with people very, very quickly. And by that afternoon, the first afternoon I was outside of the hospital, I had a new best friend, and she introduced me to a stripper named Tina, and to, back then you would call them drag queens, but now they would be trans women. It was just a different vernacular at the time. And so me and my cronies, my two fabulous creatures, and Tina, the stripper, we would... dance on gay nightclub stages, sleep in cemeteries, collect bottles to return so you can get money for food and things like that. And Tina, actually, at one point I was staying with her and she was like going to charge me money to stay there. And so I broke into my own house, my mother's house, I should say, not mine, and pawned off a bunch of Christmas presents that were there waiting for my brothers and sisters. And supported my life outside of the house. And I would also turn myself in at police stations and say, like, if I was from, say, Leeds, I would go to a Manchester and say, I'm a runaway from London. And they'd buy me a bus ticket to London. And if I got to London, then I would say, oh, I'm from Leeds. I need to go home. I have no way home. And they would buy me a bus ticket there. Or wherever I want to go to Wales. I would just pick random places and just start crisscrossing the country.
I love it.
By myself on a bus and just get somewhere for about 3 or 4 days, go to a police station, cry, repeat the same performance, and then they'd buy me another ticket to wherever I wanted to go. They were just trying to get me out of their hair, pretty much. They're like, anything to make this weird teenager go away.
I'm laughing, but you're a teenager who's homeless. 13. Like, you know, like, I mean, amazing that you even had, like, the thought to think about that sort of survival. It's a survival plan, isn't it?
It is a survival plan, yeah. And I always thought, while surviving, I might as well have fun.
And you tell the whole story with a smile on your face. Like, I don't feel, I'm sure there was a lot of emotion and darkness there, but
it was definitely, I had adventures. Yeah. You know, that's a lot of the stuff. Like, I did an interview the other night and the guy was like trying to do like sad porn about my life. And I was like, pal, no, you got it wrong. I've dealt with some hard stuff for sure. Like a lot of us have, maybe some on a global scale. No, I've had a lot of adventures and a lot of good times too. It's not a one note thing.
But do you think those hard times have helped you to be brave? Because we were talking in the break just about, you know, you coming out with your initial story that, you know, started that Me Too movement. I'm interested to know, like, what was your thoughts before breaking that news story, and how did you get the bravery and to put something out there that you knew was gonna
cause the world to shift?
That's a really big thing.
It was a huge thing, and it was, and now looking back, which is why I had to conserve some of my energy and my strength for years until I could get strong enough, because I knew I was gonna have a hell of a fight on my hands.
Did you always know you were gonna break that story though?
Yes.
You like,
it was, you
were not gonna stay silent on that.
No.
It was just a matter of when.
It was a matter of when, and Trump really helped.
Did you know it was going to shift things in the way that it did, though? Because did you not have a part? There'd be a part of me which is going to think, I'm going to say this, and maybe it'll be a story for 24 hours, and then nothing will happen.
No, I knew it would have bigger reaches because I'd also. It wasn't just like all of a sudden this article just came out. That's what it seemed like to the world. But I'd been working on that article and articles with them for a while behind the scenes, and it took me 3 years to write my book. And so I was writing my book behind the scenes while all this stuff was going on. I had 1 year left of writing my book when the article started to be written, and I needed to. It's very complicated. There's another book in how all this stuff happened, but it's a very complex and weird tale. But suffice it to say, it took an extraordinary amount of strength and almost killed me, I think. Yeah.
Was there like insider knowledge? We talk about it in other industries that when there is a man who has a reputation, and Me Too movement has kind of smoked out a lot of those guys. But there were conversations that women were saying about the guy at, say, that creative agency, the guy at that
company.
Yeah, of
course. It's just like anywhere. And it's not just the women. It's the men that know it. It's the women that support that structure. You know, it's all together.
That was one of the things
how society behaves.
Really shocked me in the book was just how much of that structure is just blasé about it. It's like,
right,
oh,
but
it's
that's
just
not
life.
Just that structure. That's also just the world. Society. Because I always say, what happens to women behind the scenes in Hollywood is what happens to us on screen. Is what happens to us in the world. Yeah. You know, there's a direct correlation, I think.
I'm having an awful lot of conversations with guys when I talk about the Me Too movement, and nearly every single white guy says to me, I think the Me Too movement has been really bad because
actually there's all the fake cases, and a fake case can bring a man's career down. And that seems to be the main, that is the main conversation I have,
right,
about Me Too.
Well, that's the two things that I got conflated. Me Too, you know, the press called it a movement. Me Too was started by an activist named Tarana Burke, a hashtag, mm-hmm. and it was simply a way for people to talk to each other. Did this happen to you? Me Too. That's literally what it actually is, people. The rest of it, for the men out there going, oh, they might lose their job, shut up. Seriously, just shut up, moron. Because here's the thing. The reality is, if they did what they're really, you know, accused of, and they do go through due process, then they'll be exonerated. If they don't, then they probably should have been convicted of a crime and not just worried about losing their jobs.
So I want to go back to the moment, because sort of part of my brain is chuckling and going, you know, you had your to-do list, pick up laundry, go to the shops, shift the world's axis, maybe not today, might do that tomorrow.
Yeah.
So the morning where you decided, or the moment you decided, what happened? Where were you? What were you doing?
Well, it was just, you know, it was actually Trump was going through his nomination process and his campaigning. And, you know, the Access Hollywood tape, you know, where he was famously, you know, grab him by the blah, blah, blah. And I just thought, oh, thank you. This is going to show people in a very black and white way what this actually is that we're talking about, you know. What this is what it looks like. It's very obvious, and it's very easy for men to be like, or women to be like, oh, they're just complaining and da 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 da. And you're like, no, this is what it is. And it took the good people on the left to be like, oh, that's what they've been talking about all along. Yes, this is what we've been talking about all along. Just like how all of a sudden with the advent of body cameras, you know, you see in America, oh, the police are shooting young black men. Yes, that's what they've been talking about for all this damn time. And it's real.
And so it was the rage of that moment where,
yes,
you were like, today is the day.
And also I was just, there's a lot more complexity behind the scenes. You know, I had the bad guy coming after me privately to shut down my book's publication. And so there's a lot of fighting going on behind the scenes with lawyers and that were secretly really working with him.
Right.
That were supposed to be working for me. My literary agent was also secretly working with him behind the scenes. It was just like, it was unreal. The amount of adversity that I faced to get this out in the world was extreme. There was $1 million bounty placed on my book, and there was $1 million going to anybody who could procure the book before its publication. And so there was a company called Black Cube that was staffed by ex-Mossad that was hired to infiltrate my life and hired a woman to pose as a sexual assault survivor. In fact, she was Mossad. And they stole 125 pages of my book before it was published.
How do you trust anyone?
I don't.
Yeah. Ever.
I was just about to ask the same. Yeah. I mean,
you don't.
I mean, I trust my partner. I trust some of my friends, but I don't. Inherently, it's always just been me. I've just been me on my own in my life, and that's how it probably will always be.
But you trusted, again, going on the journey.
I trust the universe.
At 13, you trusted enough to know that you
I trusted
could...
myself.
Trust okay. yourself, yeah.
Right.
I trusted myself. And the times I didn't trust myself is when I got the most messed with in life, you know?
Mm-hmm.
At times that I thought other people, not that they knew it was best, but if you meet people that are like all of a sudden everyone's freaking out that they're so much more powerful than you, and it puts you in this like weakened position, that's like what many people can relate to, I'm sure. And an unfair power advantage. You know, I despise people that abuse power. And I think that's a pretty clear enemy to have.
How will you stop yourself being corrupted by power that you're, you know, going to come into? Yeah.
I haven't turned into a dickhead yet.
But I mean, you know, you book out music, art, there's a conversation.
Yeah, but you also understand
swirls.
I've also went through like being famous. Yeah. I went through all of that stuff and it never turned my head. Yeah. I think I've had many opportunities to turn into a jerk before this time.
Yeah. Apologies for the use of the other word there.
What word?
Do you know what? Last time I had to apologize, I then said the word again.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
Thank you so much for staying with us, Rose. I wanted to talk to you about directing in Hollywood, because you are now, as I introduced you, you were an actress, you're now a director. And I was watching an interview with you, and you had this astonishing stat that only 96% of directors in Hollywood are men.
Correct, and that statistic hasn't changed since 1946. It's for the union is called the Directors Guild, the DGA, the Directors Guild of America, and that's largely white males, you know, and that's a very, nothing wrong with that, but that's an incredibly narrow and binary view to give the rest of the world. And people think, you know, what happens is Hollywood is just like, oh, Hollywood, those wacky weirdos, you know, like as if it stays there. Or those corrupt, you know, monsters behind the scenes, or those fake liberals, whatever they are. But it doesn't stay there. It goes all through the airwaves, and it goes, it's America's number one export. Yeah. You know, it is the propaganda machine for the mind, and it is dangerous what it peddles. If you don't look at it, you need to look at what you're consuming with a very critical eye.
One of the things that comes across in your book, Brave, is just this almost kind of like shaking the shoulders of the rest of us, being like, please look at what you're watching. Yeah. And there was a stat in there, which was 27% of lines from movies in 2016, only 27% were women, and most of those were horror movies.
Yeah.
That, because women do not come out well of the horror movies.
No, they generally don't come out well in horror movies, no. So that's where they had the most dialogue for women across any movies was in horror movies. That's when they're allowed to speak the most, but that's usually when they're yelling to fight for their lives or screaming for help.
I generally avoid horror movies, but I do like Marvel. And I watched Captain Marvel last Friday.
How was that?
I don't need highbrow entertainment to be entertained, let's just say. So I thought it was great.
No, I'm probably the last movie I saw in theaters was Mary Poppins, which I also didn't like, but I wish I had, because I really wanted to. So no, I'm not only like foofy. And believe me, the highbrow entertainment can be just as damaging and have just the same exact messaging systems. It's not just that's another mistake that people make, I think, is they think it's only like that you're attacking mainstream. It's not. It's all over the place.
How do you go about being aware? And we've had this conversation on the show before. Once you become aware of things, you then don't want to turn into a boring person that's like, I'm not going to do all of this stuff because I can see all the hidden messages and meanings. Right. So how do you walk the line between just living and existing? And
it's a really tough line. I'm really I'm pretty rigid with what I let into my brain. So for me, it's primarily reading and music. Mm-hmm. I don't watch that much cinema anymore. I just don't really. I've kind of done my time.
Other than your own movies.
Well, I studied film, and I was deeply immersed in that. And I've just, in the last couple of years, I haven't had time to really do anything other than fight. But coming back into getting to do my own creative endeavors will be certainly a welcome thing. You know, putting down the weaponry for a little bit will be nice, certainly. But it's just like if you're watching a movie and you're like, oh, why is that woman always carrying the laundry basket? She never does laundry. You know, just look at what you're watching. Mm-hmm. Like, what are they sending out to the, you know, why is it always the women in washing up commercials? Like, why? Just mm-hmm. basic stuff. You're like, come on. Like, just think deeper. Think better. Stop it. Stop. And that's part of this, like, kind of mass market indoctrination, that is so prevalent with what we were talking about earlier, going back to like how do people in a watered down society know that they're in a cult like structure too? Well, that's how you do it. You start picking it apart.
Do you think there is any impetus in Hollywood to change? Because
sure.
Well, last week we had Emma Thompson, who quit a movie because the studio re-employed somebody who had been fired just a year before from another studio for sexual harassment.
James Gunn?
No. Let me check his name. I do have it somewhere. I don't think it was, no. But
it was a Pixar guy.
Yes.
Well, good for Emma Thompson.
Yeah, she quit. But people are being re-employed left, right, and center. So.
Yeah, they are. Because that's Hollywood just wants it to go away and stop. But it's incumbent upon us and people like Emma Thompson and like the people that can exert some kind of control and power to say no. And it sucks that we have to. But until they can clean up their own backyard... Mm. You know, we're going to be the ones that have to do it.
We're knocking Hollywood quite a lot because there's lots that need to do. But you obviously really wanted to get into acting, and you've done loads.
No, I didn't actually.
You didn't.
I was discovered.
Oh, because I'm interested to know, like, were there some good bits though in terms of your career? You've done so much. You've done the music. You've done TV.
I was really good at it.
You enjoyed it.
But I was really good at it. There's a difference.
There's an interesting.
I enjoyed some. Components. I'm also good at tying my shoes, but I don't necessarily enjoy
interesting.
Doing it.
Interesting. Sorry.
Everybody assumes, but I talk about that in my book a lot about like people like, you were so lucky, you were so lucky. And I'm like, you don't know what luck is. Mm. And you're a definition of what somebody's dream might be is not my definition. Mm. And no, I was discovered 2 weeks after my boyfriend was killed. And I was standing on a street corner crying. And then 2 weeks after that, I was starring in a movie. And that's how that happened. So it was always for me a day job.
Did it
a really
feel...
unique day job, but a day job.
Did it feel good or secure to have somebody say, you're good at this, we're going to give you more work?
No, that's not how they do it. They fill you with fear that you're never going to get another job and that you have to conform and do all these, you know, what was discovered about you was that you were special, and then they do their best to kind of homogenize that out of you. But that's kind of what they do to kids in the world, right? Like, here, you're zero, you're amazing, you're an amazing, extraordinary creature, and by the time they're 5 years old, they've had their creativity stolen, and here's what you are, and here's what you can't do. It's not dissimilar.
Do you know what you would have done as a career when you look
no,
back?
No, I was so young. I really don't. Yeah. But I also talk about in my book that I always knew I was going to be famous, but I always knew it wasn't a big deal. I was like, it was just something, I was like, all right, let's do this. I know it's strange, but I've always had like kind of knowledge of what my future was going to look like.
Not strange, more heavy.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's a lot of responsibility for a young kid.
Yeah. And to me, it's then connecting the dots between if you know all of this stuff, so you know you have a superpower and you know you're going to be famous. Actually, I can see more and more now listening to why you would be like, do you know what? I'm just going to snake America on some Greyhound buses because... Yeah.
I'm going to game the system.
Yeah, basically.
I'm
going
to
game
the system. Yeah. And for a woman to do what I did and to game the system that hard is a pretty major feat of accomplishment.
And so is that part
And
of
to
the
rip
plan?
Down a power structure that needed to be tumbled. And I'm not talking about one man. I'm talking about the idea of power and what it means and how we are supposed to all just obey it because it is. Mm. You know, that's what I'm fundamentally opposed to.
So is that the plan going forward?
That's the plan going forward.
With books and music and
keep
art.
Keep pushing
and
at it.
Yeah.
Just keep pushing at it.
How do you think social media has transformed power in society?
I mean, it's both things. It's both, you know, the mob at the door and also something that gives somebody a voice when they didn't have one. You know, so it's a double-edged sword, but I think it's, if we can start wielding it wisely, and one of the things I did was about 4 years ago, I started following different, like, editors and people in the media business, like reporters, publishers, like from all over the world, like Hindustan Times, I would follow their deputy editor, or I would follow the Paducah, Kentucky outlet, you know, whatever it was, the number two on their masthead. And I would start strategically doing this so they would pay attention who's verified that's following them. And then whenever I tweet something, they're like, oh, they won't, they're, so they're now paying attention to what I'm saying, and I can disseminate information that way. Mm. So that's kind of what I do.
What's a cult versus a movement?
Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know about movements. I know what a cult is, and I think a movement, I mean, that's the whole thing. They keep calling it a Me Too movement, but I'm like, who's the person that's, there's no like Martin Luther King Jr. like taking people down a street. It's not that kind of thing. It was largely media created that word attached to it, you know, and it was a way for the media to control the information that was getting out about itself, really.
Do you think that there is no kind of Martin Luther King Jr. leader of Me Too? I'm putting leader in quotes, so like, but no kind of figurehead for it, because it's a movement that was started by women.
No, I think it's because it's a reset button. I think it did what it came to do. I think it pushed a button, and it's like we just needed to shift our lenses by about 10% and start seeing each other as more human. And I think it did what it came to do. And its effects, you know, will reverberate and keep continuing to be felt, but it's not something where it's like there's a lobbyist force or there's people that are, you know, it's now, like, what I wanted to do was not about Me Too at all. My book and everything is about just challenging thought, you know, and the power structure, the greater power structure. It's not about Hollywood. It's not about any of that stuff. And it's, you know, sexual harassment is just the flaming spear tip that I wrote in on, but that's not my mission, not by a long shot, no.
Do you think feminism challenges thought? Would you describe yourself as a feminist?
I always say yes because I'm not stupid. I mean, duh. You know, anybody, do you believe in equal pay for women and equal rights? Congratulations, you too are a feminist. Yeah, it seems like a pretty basic
human, you know, right.
Thing. It seems like a basic logic thing here, but overall, my you know, I would say I'm a humanist, I guess, if I had to be an ist of something. I think I get really, really bored with the gender thing, and I'm much more interested in people if they could stop seeing themselves as women and stop seeing themselves as men, because they're so born into the system, if they could actually see themselves as human, what were you before you were told what you are? Before they massaged your brain and telling you what you could be because you are this. You know, what if you actually went before that? I mean, I think then we could actually have a lot freer conversations. The mind would be more unlocked. I think we could really then accomplish some things.
And so on that, but also on the 10% shift, because it was a 10% shift that was actually a really huge shift. You're calling for people to be 10% better in their lives.
Yes.
What does that look like for someone that is, you know, going about life
practically perfect? Is that what you're going to say?
I well, now if you're thinking about
you're
me,
like,
yeah.
If it applies,
I mean, yeah. And yeah.
If it's possible,
yeah. I was thinking about more other people, but yes. Like, how does the normal person walking around, just waking up, what does 10% look like for them?
Well, for me, you know, whenever I'm, and I did this growing up because I didn't have a lot of supervision, it was mostly just myself, and I was like, okay, whenever I would be scared or I was in a situation that I didn't know how to handle or that needed just even a little situation that needed guidance, I would imagine what the best version of me would do, and I would just imitate that. And that's how I raised myself. Mm-hmm. And so I think if it's like, what does it mean being 10% better? What would the best version of you do in your life in any given situation, both small and big, and just act as if until it comes true?
Do you think you're ever done with that extra 10% improvement, though?
No, you keep going. No.
I'm going to commit to 10% less red wine.
All right. Every little helps.
Badass Women's Hour XL on Talk Radio.
She'll get you talking.
We've talked a lot about kind of your life and Hollywood and the incredible movements that you have been part of and put yourself out there with. How was it writing a book about all of that? Was it cathartic or was it exhausting?
It was both. Mm-hmm. And I got asked a lot about whether writing was cathartic while I was writing it, and I was saying, no, it's hell. You know, I mean, Hemingway says, writing is easy. You just sit at the typewriter and bleed. And that's kind of what it felt like, you know, minus the typewriter, and we have a laptop now. But it was definitely like calling on ghosts. You know, the 3 years that I was writing it, I was really mad at my dad, and I didn't visit his grave the whole time I was writing it. I was too angry. I didn't want to deal with him. Because I was dealing with them so much in the book. And then, the second it was published, like, he and I, not that he has much choice in the matter at this point, but he and I, no, like, I can, it was like it healed something. And I've been able to spend a lot of time at the cemetery with him, and it's good.
Would you do it again?
Oof. I think that this book is kind of in a weird way, a strange form of a Bible for our times now, you know? And I think you only write that kind of thing once. But I have other books in me, but not this book. This book is very special.
How do you summon up the energy to be creative? Because you are dealing with a lot, right? Yeah. I mean, I can imagine if you just look at Twitter for 10 minutes in the morning, I would then need to take a nap.
You want to kill yourself.
Yeah, like it's intense.
It is intense.
How do you kind of build up the resilience to deal with that and still have the energy to create?
Well, in the last year and a half, I couldn't create. I had to put everything on the back burner. I was just fighting and I was on the ropes every day, you know, and it was just coming from one direction or another. And it was a global fight. And I knew that if not me, whom? Mm. And so one of the things that I've really think is I've been learning a lot about is self-care. And for a long time, I thought that meant like getting a pedicure.
Yeah.
Apparently, it's more involved.
Yeah, pedicure's good for like an
hour. I was like, yeah, I get a pedicure. Yeah, I get it. They're like, do you practice self-care? I'm like, yeah, I get a pedicure once a month or so.
What?
Apparently, there's more things to it.
What's your self-care like? Yeah. What do you do to self-care? Because I think you're right. I think there is a misconception. You light some candles, you have a bath, and that's self-care.
Right, exactly. Yeah. I think for me, it was really learning boundaries. And, like, my girlfriend the other day was like, can I use the flat to have all these people over to film something? I'm like, no. I love you, but no. I no. And that's just because for me, like, my space is really, really critically important because the world is very scary. And I have, like I try to control, not control, it's the wrong word. It's almost like, you have to make sure the frequency that you're on matches the outside frequency. And that's a hard thing to negotiate sometimes as like a sensitive, creative person, I suppose.
Have you found it hard instilling those boundaries? Because I think you're right. I feel like boundaries is one of the most important things you can do.
It took me a long time.
But it's really hard to go to say no. And also not to say no, I'm really sorry, but
right.
You can't,
I was like,
and
no.
Give a million excuses as to why they can't, rather than just no.
No. And I was just like, no. And I was really proud of myself. And I was like, look, the world didn't stop rotating. They're like, okay. And just go on to the next point.
Yeah.
It's just not that big of a deal. You know, a lot of times people make things that, you know, oh, if I say no to this, then, you know, but it's like by saying no to something, what are you saying yes to? Yeah. You're saying yes to either yourself or to a better experience. Mm.
So many people struggle with that, though.
It's a real struggle.
Yeah. Well, it's confrontation, though, isn't it? Because someone but you care about is asking something.
But it's not confrontation.
No, but I guess if someone you care about is asking you something, you
I mean,
want
it
to
depends on
them.
The ask. And of course, if it's something that's really meaningful, that's different. Yeah. If it's like, can I have a party here? No. Can I have a bunch of people that you don't know in your bedroom or in your flat? No.
I actually always think that's the defining moment when you know you've become an adult. I remember when I was about a few years ago and I was flat sharing and I had a much younger flatmate, and I woke up on a Saturday morning and there were bodies kind of strewn across the flat, and I had this moment where I was like, no. And I was like, that's it. A year ago, I would have been like, yeah, great, fine. No, done here. Too old for this now. Moving on.
And do you still have that flatmate?
No. I moved out. I was like, my time here is done. I need to go get my own place. Rose, what is next for you?
Well, what's next for me is I'm doing some awesome dates.
You are. We have them here.
Yeah, what are
those
dates?
Going on tour. You are 26th of April, Chester Story House, Chester. Lovely. 27th of April, National Concert Hall, Dublin. 4th of May, South Bank Centre, Queen Elizabeth Hall here in London. And 5th of May, Lowry at Salford Quays.
What's Lowry at Salford Quays?
Well, Salford Quays is up near Manchester, she says.
Oh, okay.
Hopefully.
It is.
Good, yes. Thank you. I don't know what the Lowry is. I have not been there, but it sounds delightful.
Lowry is delightful. It's a beautiful, beautiful theatre.
Oh, I'm really excited. I can't wait to go. And then I have an album coming out this summer called Planet Nine, and the album I was working on concurrently with the book is kind of what kept me sane. And the album, I'm playing my first dates at the Fringe Festival, actually, in August. Oh, yeah.
That's exciting.
What sort of music is it?
It's like music to go to space, too.
Okay. Great.
Yeah. And there's a couple songs now up on Spotify. If you just put in my name, you can work it out. There's one called RM486 that I really love.
Oh, yeah, I heard about this. Okay. And that's named after...
It's a mixture between my initials and the famously controversial abortion drug, RU486. Mm. And it made it so, like, when I released a song, like, Rolling Stone was interviewing me. They're like, so, tell us about the name. I'm like, funny you should ask. Let's discuss women's rights. I'm like, no!
Judy.
No!
Judy.
She tricked us. And I was like, yes, I did. But the lyrics in that are, held my hand up to the stars, gilded lilies driving cars. It's time to say it, so I will. I can, I do, I vow to live. To all of us lost in time, to those waiting to be picked up, to those who cry and bleed and die, to those with the unnatural sigh. And then the chorus is, only here to paint colors on the sun, only here to see the fires run. Because that's really all we're here to do. We're just here to paint colors on the sun.
It's like poetry.
Yeah, amazing lyrics.
Yeah. I think we've all just fallen a little bit in love. Rose, thank you so much for coming in and joining us. Obviously, this week is the Weinstein trial. He denies the allegations. When it's over, how are you going to feel?
Oh, I don't want to talk about any of that because I don't want to have my life distilled down to what happens to a man's life, how it'll affect me. And I can't time travel forward. It's going to be triggering and hard, as one would imagine. But there's no chance but to pull up your bootstraps and keep marching forward.
Beautiful. Thank you very much. The fabulous Rose McGowan, thank you so much for coming in and joining us. You've been an amazing interview. 1, 2, 3, 4! This has been the Badass Women's Hour podcast with me, Harriet Minter, Natalie Campbell and Emma Sexton. If you want to hear more from us, you can come follow us on social media at Badass Women's Hour, HR, or leave us a review and tell us how much you love us. We really need to feel the love. 5 stars should do it.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hold up.
What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.